Aaron Friedman, Monday, July 4th, 2016. Can modern Orthodox rabbis be part of the halacha conversation?
Good morning, everybody, and happy July 4th. I want to dedicate this shiur to my father's memory. Today is his first yahrzeit. My father was a Holocaust survivor who escaped from increasingly communist Czechoslovakia after World War II to live in the freedom of this country, and certainly appreciated the freedom of the United States. And you know what? July 4th commemorates the American Revolution, which, even though it preceded the French Revolution by 13 years, a lot of the ideas of the American Revolution were developed in France and came from French thinking about freedom, and even though it took the French 13 years later, the ideas actually were from the French. So I think it's only fitting that we spend time today discussing a technological innovation that actually originated in France in the early 1800s and wound its way to other parts of the Jewish world. So we're going to study the technological innovation is the machine that makes matzah, which actually was invented in France. And that sounds strange to us, but we'll get to that in a moment. You wouldn't think that that's where that machine would have been invented, except for the innovative, entrepreneurial spirit that the French Revolution ideas maybe inculcated. What was the reason why it was invented in France? So we're going to study how the traditional rabbis in Eastern Europe viewed this technological innovation and the Industrial Revolution in general. And, even though the innovation came with an approval from rabbis in Western Europe, that didn't necessarily mean much to the rabbis in Eastern Europe when they had to face it. And we are going to have to do a little history and geography in terms of what Eastern Europe and Western Europe mean, because they're not what we really think they mean. But we'll get to that shortly as well. So we'll discuss several issues which the debate turned on, but we'll focus on the geography and the sociology of it. And we'll see how the Jewish newspaper, this is also a technological innovation, the idea of Jewish media, how Jewish media affected this debate, because Jewish media was already incipient at that point in 1858. So, as I had said before, the first machine to make matzahs was invented in the 1830s in France, but in the part of France that really was culturally Germany, but politically France. We're talking about Alsace, the northeastern part of France. You could look even today at a map of France, the northeastern part of France, all the names of the towns are German. And the Jews that were there were really German Jews who happened to have been living there when that part of France became part of France. So culturally, they were German Jews. Their Nusach was German. You can see that even today if you go to the Great Synagogue of Paris on Friday night, you'll see how they daven Kabbalah Shabbos. They use these Alsatian tunes. They say the Lechun Aranna responsively. They daven the way the Yekis do, and the way specifically Alsatian Jews do, because the majority of the Ashkenazi Jews of France were coming from this area, Alsace-Lorraine, the part that borders on Germany. So there you did have you had many Jewish communities that were small, but they were compact, and they were in need of matzah, and somebody who had entrepreneurial and mechanical skills figured out a way to make a machine that basically allows you to make matzah a lot more quickly than if you do it by hand. So it was invented, as I said, in the 1830s. It got the approval of local rabbis, of the rabbi of Strasbourg, which was one of the bigger cities in the area, and of the consistoire of Paris, the chief rabbinate, so to speak, of France, which also approved, as I said, this machine. The machine, as I said, enabled the dough to be rolled in very large. People who went to elementary school and were taken to the matzah factory know this. You know, you take the dough after you knead it, you can put it into the machine, and it can make this huge sheet of dough that's flattened out and then pressed down shapes of the matzah in it. And then once that happens, you can quickly get it into the oven. And so it actually, from a halachic standpoint, you would think is actually a better thing, because it minimizes the time that that elapses between the time the water and the flour first mix and the time it gets into the oven, which, you know, the maximum time it could be is 18 minutes. So the 18 minutes are certainly cut shorter if you're using mechanical means to speed up the process. Mishpacha magazine, actually a few years ago, had an article about somebody who went through all these old, small communities of Alsace, of this part of France, where there still are these old shuls. Unfortunately, there are no Jews living there. The shuls themselves are not in use. And there are old matzah factories to visit, besides the old shuls. So I was thinking about that, and we'll get back to that at the end. But, you know, you talk about these Jewish heritage tours, but that's the question. Is this heritage or just Jewish anti-heritage tour to go to visit matzah factories, since the heritage of Jews before was to make the matzahs by hand? But you can actually visit these old matzah factories in Alsace even today. In the 1840s, but again, I said it was invented in the 1830s. In the 1840s and by the early to mid 1850s, the machine had spread. You know, Caedmont, Telfona, it got to London, to Germany, which is the important part here. It went even to the far reaches of the Jewish communities that spoke German. So you had the machines not only in what we would call Germany today, but in parts of Germany that today are Poland or Slovakia, the Czech Republic. So you had the machine in Pressburg, which is Bratislava, the capital of Slovakia, which was a German Jewish community in Vienna, and most important for us, in what's the Posen province of East Prussia. Okay, and I'll pick up a map. That's the beauty of having this here on a weekday, that I can show you a map of what Poland looked like in 1858. So at this point, you have the machine, as I said, in Vienna, Pressburg, East Prussia, and let's take a look at what. There was no Poland, by the way. We know this, I think. There was a partition of Poland in the late 1700s, and Poland didn't come back as a country until after World War I. So the partition of Poland left Poland in three parts. Maybe you can see it here. A lot of what we call Poland was East Prussia. So cities like Danzig, Gdansk in today's Polish, but in German you would say Danzig, were really part of Germany, part of East Prussia. Torun in Poland, but Thorn in German. Posen itself, which is today Poznan in Poland, was a German Jewish city. Rabbi Kivega was the Rav in Posen, and his son was the Rav after him. Breslau, which is again today Poland. These are all heavily, and not just heavily, they were German. There weren't really Poles there at the time, and the communities, the Jewish communities, were certainly Polish. And then, if you see here, the blue, what we call southeastern Poland, was really Austrian, part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It was part of Galicia. All of Galicia was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So cities like Krakow, okay, Lemberg, Lviv, which is today Ukraine, were all part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and Brody, which is also going to come up here. And though we would see, you know, the capital of Poland, Warsaw, was part of the Russian Empire. So you had the northern part of Poland, and the coastal part was part of Germany. The southeastern part was part of Austria. And there was this area jutting in, you know, this west bank, so to speak, that jut in, which was part of the Russian Empire. So what happened here, and the reason why we're, you know, focused on this, is that in the late 1850s, the machine, which already was accepted all over East Prussia in the German part of Poland, started to migrate to Galicia, to places like Krakow, Lemberg, and Brody, which are part of the Austrian part of Poland. I don't know why there was no discussion that I could find about the machine in, let's call it, Congress Poland, the heart of Poland, which was part of Russia. For some reason, the rabbis, all the rabbis who spoke about this, were either from the Austro-Hungarian part of Poland or from Germany itself. They were not from the Congress Poland or the central heart of Poland. Okay, so we had our history here. So the trigger event, as I said, was the move of the machine from the Prussian part of Poland to the Austrian part of Poland. Okay, and the first salvos already began in the year 1858. There was a man named Reb Chaim Nussen Dembitzer, who was a dayan in Krakow, which, as I said, Krakow was right on the border. We can pass this around if you want. You can see Krakow is right on the border, the northernmost part of Austrian Poland, on the border with Russian Poland. So Reb Chaim Nussen Dembitzer was kind of very close to the Prussian part of Poland, and when the machine came to Krakow, he got upset, because he felt that there were real issues, halachic issues, with the machine. And he enlisted to his help Rav Shlomo Kluger, who was a very well-known Rav, an author, was already about 70 years old, and he was the Rav of the town of Brody, which is, again, the Austrian part of Poland, but on the border with Russia. And so he, Rav Shlomo Kluger, wrote letters against the machine, against those who wanted to, those who ate matzah that was made by the machine, and against the rabbis in Germany, which included East Prussia, who had given their hashgacha, so to speak, to the machine. Okay, so when it's done, pass it back, because I'll need it to quote something. So Reb Chaim Nussen Dembitzer assembled these letters. They were actually only published in 1859, a year later. The reason why he published the pamphlet was, we're going to see soon, is that in 1856, the first Hebrew weekly newspaper started publishing. It was called Hamagid. It was printed in a place called Lutsk, which was in the East Prussian part of Poland. Today we would call it Lithuania, because it's right near Bialystok. But again, culturally, it was part of Germany at the time. And it started publishing weekly, and it actually lasted for over 50 years. So, 2 years after it already had come into existence in 1856, they became aware of the fight that was going on in Krakow, in Brody. That is the city of Rav Chaim Nussen Dembitzer, Krakow, and the city of Rav Shlomo Kluger, Brody. He became aware, the authors of the editors of this newspaper became aware of it, and it became something to write about. Jews were interested in reading about the fight, and, the rabbis here said this, the rabbis here said that, and there was going to be another rabbi from Galicia who took the side of the German rabbis, which made it even more interesting to read about in the newspaper. So we have Reb Chaim Nussen Dembitzer assembling these letters, against the letters to the editor and the articles that he was reading about in Hamagid, eventually publishing them a year later in this book called Moda'a LeBeis Yisrael. You can get it on HebrewBooks.org. Moda'a, if you're going to search it in Hebrew, Moda'a ends with an Aleph, not with a Hey. So if you search Moda'a with a Vav, Moda'a LeBeis Yisrael, you will find the book. You actually find, as we have an excerpt from it, there's actually a reprint of it from the 20th century that has both that book and the book that Reb Shlomo Nathanson, who was the Rav of Lemberg, wrote against the pamphlet, which was called Bitul Moda'a. So you can actually get them in one set. There's Moda'a LeBeis Yisrael and Bitul Moda'a. These are both phrases from the Gemara. The Bitul Moda'a obviously was written against the announcement that the machine was not kosher. Okay, so you have basically two people putting out pamphlets. You have newspaper articles and letters to the editor about it, and people who are getting involved because you have Reb Chaim Nussen Dembitzer assembling people to fight it, and you have Reb Shlomo Yossi Nathanson, who is the Rav of Lemberg, assembling people to support it. So you can guess, but I'll tell you that the Hasidic rabbis at the time, none of these people that we mentioned so far were Hasidim. Reb Shlomo Kluger was not a Hasid. Reb Chaim Nussen Dembitzer was not a Hasid. Reb Yossi Nathanson was not a Hasid. They were from Jews, very learned, but they were not Hasidim, but there was already a large Hasidic community in what's today Poland. And, so the Hasidic rabbis also got involved, because they were asked to, and that, we're talking about the Ger Rebbe, the Chidush HaYorim, and the Sanzer, and those, you can guess, came out against the machine, and the machine matzahs. The issues aren't even that, the issues, the fight's interesting. The halakhic issues aren't as interesting, but I can tell you what they were. You can pretty much guess what they were. There were basically three or four issues. One was lishma. Especially, again, we know that the shmur matzah that you eat at the Seder, the two Seders, has to be made lishma. What does lishma mean? You have to have them in mind when you're doing X, and I'll tell you what X is in a moment, that you're doing it l'shem mitzvah matzah. What is X? What needs to be done lishma? So certainly, from the lisha, from the kneading on, from the part, from the time that the flour and the water come together, and you're kneading the dough, and forward, the activities that you're doing, you have to have intent that it be done lishma. And the intent has to be, this is interesting, and you know this from economics, from visiting the matzah factory, you don't have men doing it, the women are often the ones who are doing the lishma at the kneading phase of the matzah making. But you can't have non-Jews, and you can't have people who have the defective mental capacity. And the question was, can the machine have lishma? So that was one of the attacks. And the answer was, obviously, it's not the machine. What's the difference if you use a wooden roller and you have lishma, or you push a button that makes a metal roller run the flour through, the dough through, and you have intent lishma when you push the button. So why is that lishma not good and this lishma good? That was the argument in terms of lishma. There was an argument about, and this has to do with tradition again, we'll come to this again, what do hand matzahs look like? They're round, right? And what do machine matzahs look like? They're square. Well, they didn't, it's kind of like when you watch, if you look at pictures of the first automobiles that they invented, they made them look like carriages that are drawn by horses. Because that was the thing that they understood. They didn't, they couldn't sell it, This is a horse's carriage, but the horse's carriage actually looked like a horse-drawn carriage. Eventually, they realized that there were aerodynamics and other issues that made it more sensible to design a car differently than a carriage that's pulled by a horse. But when you're first coming out with, if you're going to market matzahs to the Jewish community, and they're used to seeing round matzahs every year, you're going to give them square matzahs, it's not going to sell. Even, if you can convince them that there's no kashrus issue, in fact that the kashrus may be better. It doesn't matter, it's just not going to work. The optics don't work. So they made them round. But the way they made them round, you had a circle and a square. So they'd have to cut out a circle in the square, and then they had extra dough. And then that dough, what would they do with it? They'd throw it back into the beginning of the machine, and then they'd roll it again. Then that dough could have been out there for 18 minutes. So that was another one of the tainas against the round machine matzahs, that you really didn't know when they came out round whether this was on the first round or for the second round, pardon the pun, the first round or the second round, and maybe it was chametz, after that many minutes out there. So the issue of the shape of the matzah was actually an issue of chametz. And then, of course, the issue that we always were told about, which is that there are pieces of dough that can get stuck in the machinery that is so complex, much more complex than the hand process. So that dough could actually roll itself back into the new dough, and then you get some more than 18-minute dough mixed with the 18-minute dough. Okay. I wanted my, and I'm sorry I didn't put this in the sources, but we'll go to the sources shortly. As I said, in the booklet, Modol LeBeis Yisrael, that Rav Shlomo Kluger wrote in, it was assembled by Rav Chaim Nassim Demetzer. So Rav Shlomo Kluger went through these arguments in the first letter. And he goes on and on, and then at the end of it he says, Al Kain, and you don't have this, so I'll read it and I'll translate it. Al Kain, Al Tishanu Miminag Avoseichem. Okay? Don't change the custom of your fathers, don't start using these machine matzahs. Ha'ashkenazim yasu mashalibayim chofetz kedarko. The Ashkenazim, the German Jews, will do mashalibam chofetz. It's a very negative term. It's, everything here is like hypertext. You know, when you see they write in rabbinic phrases, the Gemara talks about somebody who has this uncontrollable urge to commit an avera. You can imagine what kind of an avera it is. You should go to some place where nobody knows you. You should wear, put on black clothing, and you should do mashalibam chofetz. You know, so he's, that's what he's saying. Ashkenazim, let them do mashalibam chofetz kedarkam, as is their want, as they, you know, they always do this. They always go off and do things the way mashalibam chofetz. But we will follow the footsteps of our fathers. We will not move from those footsteps, right or left. Their schus, right, following our father's footsteps and not going off their path right or left, that will defend us so we can go back to our land. Okay, etc. That is the end of the letter. So clearly the perception here is that we have a group of rabbis from the west or the north, right, who do mashalibam chafetz. They do halachas their way. Okay? And it's not the way our fathers did it. It's probably not the way their fathers did it. And we don't accept that. And we're not going to use their matzahs. And yeshchus. And what's going to bring Mashiach? Not keeping mitzvahs, not eating matzah, but keeping the ways of our father, not moving right or left, and not doing what the Germans, the Ashkenazim, do. Okay. So that is basically the summation of his halachic arguments on the subject. Okay. Which is that basically these Ashkenazim don't have a say in this process. Okay. Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson, he's like your own man says it, like when you're playing basketball and your group is, there's a question of whether the guy stepped out of bounds or not. So, the people on one team say, of course he didn't. The people on the other team say, of course he did. And there's always one guy on the team that's claiming that he didn't step out of bounds. He said, no, actually, he did step out of bounds. And then you say, your own man says it. And that's it. That's the end of the argument. When somebody on the team who's trying to put in a forward position A says position B, then you can't really say position A anymore. So it would have been good if everybody was Ashkenazi, but there wasn't. There was this one man who was totally accepted as a learned man, and he had written many svarim. Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson, he was the Rav of Lemberg, which was in Galician Poland, right not far from Brody, from Reb Shlomo Kluger, who very much supported the matzah machine. So much so that he, as I said, was the one who assembled all the letters in the Bitul Moda and published it himself in Lemberg in the same year, in 1859. So he was the one who really was the fly in the ointment. Okay, let's talk a little about him. He's a fascinating person in his own right. He was born about 1810, so he was about 30 years younger than Rav Shlomo Kluger. Rav Shlomo Kluger was about 70 at the time. Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson was about 50. Okay, and he was a descendant. They were all into that. He was descendant of a previous well-known Rav of Lemberg, Rav Mordechai Zeev Orenstein. He was a cousin and a brother-in-law. That is his wife's. His wife's brother was named Mordechai Zeev Ettinger. Mordechai Zeev Ettinger and Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson, they were both sitting and learning until their 40s. That's what they did. They didn't do anything else. They were not rabbis. They sat and they learned, and they became tremendous Talmidei Chacham. They published their own Sfarim together. It's very rare in rabbinics that you have Sfarim that are published by two people together. And they published a whole bunch of them that were very well received in the rabbinic world. In 1857, a year before all this, the rabbinate in Lemberg position came open to be chief rabbi of Lemberg, which Lemberg was one of the two biggest cities in Galician Poland. The other one was Krakow. So Lemberg position comes open. You have these two people. They're both grandchildren of the big rabbi. They're brothers-in-law. They're both built Talmidei Chachamim. Only one of them is going to get it. And Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson got it, and Rav Mordechai Zeev Ettinger did not. And for the rest of his life, he didn't do anything. Rav Mordechai Zeev Ettinger, he just sat and learned. He never took a position elsewhere. And all the love that they had with each other stopped. And you could see the vicious way that they talk about each other in the Bitul Mordah and in the Mordah of Eis Yisrael about this issue, the Mishum Matzis, where Mordechai Zev Ettinger was the second person after Reb Shlomo Kluger against the Mishum Matzis. And his brother-in-law, Rabbi Yosef Shon Natanson, was the one who organized the whole Bitul Mordah, the whole fight against them and for the Mishum Matzis. So there's clearly personality differences and personality fights, family fights. Who knows what it was that you can almost see when you read it. You know, he says he saw the machine, and that's why he saw. You know, Rabbi Yosef Shon Natanson is writing this about his brother-in-law. He says he saw the machine. He said he saw the palms. I don't think he saw it. That's the way he is. He talks about things that as if he saw them, but he really didn't see them. But even if he saw them, he's wrong. You know, that's the, you know, the rawness of the fight makes for fascinating reading in the pamphlets, in Bitul Mordah and in Mordah of Eis Yisrael. So that is the one who led the... and as I said, he was very well regarded. He wrote many, many stories, both before with his brother-in-law and after without his brother-in-law. He was also known as the Sar HaMaskim, because he wrote Haskamas on almost any sefer that came out in Galicia. So he was the one, you know, it's hard to find a sefer that does not have his Haskama. He knew a lot, and he just... it was an independent thinker, as we see. So as I said, he assembled these letters, and you can see them in the Bitul Mordah. I did... you can look at it, start looking at the sources. I did photocopy, and this is not from the original printing. This is from the 1970s. If you look at this page where there's like lists of rabbis, okay? Let's take a peek at who's at the lineups here. This Mafteach came from the 20th century edition, which, as I said, put the two pamphlets together, right? Something that they wouldn't have wanted with each other. They put the Bitul Mordah and the Mordah of Eis Yisrael in one volume. Mordah of Eis Yisrael came first. And on the right two columns, you'll see all the people who are writing letters that are part of the Mordah of Eis Yisrael. On the left two columns, you see all the people who are in the Bitul Mordah. So if you take a quick look, as I said, the first one is the Shlomo Kluger, the Rav Brody. The second one is the Maamar Mordechai, which somebody said Mishnah Berurah quotes 150 times. Maamar Mordechai, which is the brother-in-law of Yosef Shon Natanson, the Mordechai Zev Ettinger, same person. And then come the Hasidic. You have the Rav Chaim Halberstam, the first sons of Rebbe. Okay. The Gera Rebbe is at the bottom of the list there. Rav Yitzchak Mordechai Alter, right? The Chidushei Harim. Okay. And the others are lesser known. And then Rav Shlomo Kluger back at the end, except at the very end you have Rav Dov Ben Meisels, who is the Rav in Warsaw. So there is one from Russian Poland, I take it back. On the left, you know, that's columns A and B. Columns B and C, you have a lineup, and as I said, the Bitul Mordah came afterwards, so he made sure to get twice as many rabbis in his list. Although, if you look at who they are, where they come from, you'll see that his geography was limited. So first comes of Yosef Shon Natanson, the Sholom Meshi, which is his famous collection of tshuvos, right? And then he has his own Hakdama there, and then there's a letter that they threw him from the son of Reb Shlomo Kluger, Reb Shimon Aryeh Shvabker. You see that one? Okay. Who is Reb Shimon Aryeh Shvabker? He was the Rav. People, you know, the history of Lemberg, again, Lemberg was in Austrian Poland. It was very subject to German influence because it was part of Austria. And there was actually big fights already in 1840s about the nature of the rabbinate and the nature of the Jewish community in Lemberg. There were very many Jews who wanted a shul where they had a dignified choir, where the rabbi wore, you know, the vestments and spoke in German. And in fact, they actually hired one rabbi, his name was Abraham Cohen, to be, quote-unquote, like a reform rabbi in Lemberg. He was poisoned and died. Because of it, Michael Stanislavski wrote a book about it. I think he called it Murder in Lemberg. But Lemberg was a place that had a fight going on between Jews who wanted more modernity and Jews who were more traditional. Rav Shimon Aryeh Shvabker, who worked with Rav Shaul Yosef Natanson on many issues, was actually the rabbi of that community, the rabbi of that shul. He was the rabbi of the German temple, so to speak, in Lemberg. It was separate seating. They didn't do anything wrong. There was no organ. There was nothing, you know, like the Reformed German shuls that they... But it wasn't the kind of shul that the fathers and the fathers of the fathers had davened in. But that was his ally. That's the one of the first people on his list here. He ended up going to Odessa, which was an even more reform-oriented kind of place, where he was for many years the rabbi of that town. So you have Reb Shimon HaYishvabker. That was the one local. Okay. Skip a few more. He had his father. Okay. Of Yaakov Ettlinger, the Aruch Lener, okay, in Altona, which is Germany. Okay. So not everybody who's for this machine is somebody who's, you know, disrespected in the world of Torah study, right? The Aruch Lener is for it. The Yitzhak Dov Bamberger, the next one. He's also an interesting person. He was the Würzburger Rav. Ask people from the Breuss community who know their history what they think of him. He was the bad boy to Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, because he was against the Austrian, the moving away, the separation of the Orthodox community from the general Jewish community. He was otherwise a very learned person. It was like the Rabbi Yosef Shalom Atlasan, the machine matzos, was Rabbi Yitzhak Bamberger was to German Neo-Orthodoxy. You know, he was everything that Shimshon Raphael Hirsch stood for, except that he didn't want to separate. And for that reason, there is an animus towards him in the Breuss community, even today among the people who know the story. So he was in support of the...
He didn't want to separate what?
He didn't want to separate from the general Jewish community, to make a separate Orthodox community, like Rabbi Hirsch did. And that's why they did not get along. Rabbi Hirsch is not on this list, you'll see. Although he was already in Frankfurt. Top of the second column, Rabbi Saul Lipschitz of Danzig, which we said is part of Eastern Prussia. He was the author of the Teferis Yisrael, the commentary on the Mishnah. He's on the list of the supporters of the Masa. The one is like the most surprising one on this list is the one right after him, the Ksav Sofer, the son of the Ksav Sofer, a person who was radically opposed to a lot of innovation and change in Jewish life. But yet, his son is writing in the Bitul Moldah in favor of the machine matzahs.
Where is he?
He's in Pressburg.
It's not in Western.
It's in today. It's Slovakia, but it's a half hour away from Vienna. It's a very German community. I think it's Bratislava. I think it's the capital of Slovakia. Okay, and then actually they have the takanos from the Ksav Sofer after that about how you make machine matzahs. Okay, so and then later on you see a Rav from Vienna, from Worms, Lisa, which is again East Posen province in East Prussia, Krakow. They did find a rabbi in Krakow, and they even found somebody in Brody in the town of Shlomo Kluger to come out in favor of machine matzahs. So they did what they could. The list is pretty heavily slanted towards rabbis from the German orbit, but there are a couple even from Galicia itself. So, yeah.
Okay. Is there an underlying current to the discussion is the economic sort of the price of machine matzahs significantly cheaper?
That's a very good question. It came up, and it still comes up. The historians who wrote about this, even people with PhDs in economics have written about it. One of the other arguments of Shlomo Kluger, which I didn't mention, was that a lot of poor people look forward to this season. It's kind of like, you know, before Christmas at Walmart. You can get jobs that you can't get all year round. So there's all these jobs that you need making the matzah. The poor people, I mean, you think the matzah factories, the people who work there are not, you know, people with the kind of education level that you want your kids to marry, right? But they're there, and this is their chance to get some money so they can make Pesach for themselves. So what you're doing by mechanizing it is all the toll takers are now going to be, you know, out of jobs. So the argument against it was these are the peripheral people in society. They don't follow the rules. Sometimes they sneak in their own sandwiches. You tell them 18 minutes, they do what they want. There's a reason why they haven't gotten ahead in life, and they have to take on these kind of jobs. And we can't trust them to be able to make matzah. Here you have a machine which you know is going to follow your dictates, whereas a person you have to worry about human error or worse. So there was definitely an argument about that, an argument also about, well, we'll see this actually later, about Maybe the people who owned the machines gave money to the rabbis to give them hashgachas. You know, then again, what about the people who own the hand matzah bakeries? You know, they also have an incentive to give the rabbis money to say that the machines for. You know, there's a lot of you can suspect a lot of things, and you can find it actually at the time and certainly since then. Okay, so I wanted to ask this question. As I said, we have these booklets from 1859, but what triggered the booklets was articles that started already in 1858, which we're going to see a little bit of. There are if you take the page that has the cross out, I don't know why the cross out's there. I'm dying to know what it says. But this is from the website of the Jewish National Library, in the Israel National Library, and that's the version that's available. Okay, so I just want we can summarize it. No, actually, we can skip through. We can go through a little bit. Let's look at March 26th. You have three articles here, right? March 26th. There's a letter to the editor of April 15th, and then there's a statement from Reb Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, who's also a well-known person, from April 28th. Okay, but let's look at the March 26th, 1858. So this is the first of all, it says Österreich, right? Austria. It's not Austria, but that's what they called Austria. Galicia and Galician Poland was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So you want to know about news from Austria, you're going to find out about what's going on in Lemberg and Krakow. So what's going on in Austria? The Erz Galician, right? Rosh Chodesh Nisan, Mahuma, right? Mevucha, Po, Eretz Azos. Mishtei HaMetropolim Shalom. It's two largest cities, Areheim, Adas Krakow, Adas Lvov. Lvov is Lemberg, right? Okay. Mishtei Anhuvu, right, Mashina, right? Asher Tasana Bar HaMatzah Salchaga Pesach. So in both these two cities, this year, a machine was imported which can make matzahs. Ve'hine, im onam, shonim avos, asher yopu HaMatzahs Beretz Ashkenaz, right? There are many, many years already, 20 years or so, that in Germany, they're making matzahs with machines. Ve'chilos Yisrael, can you read the next word? I don't know. Sorry for the level of the photocopy. Right? Nonetheless, the people of Galicia did not want to rely. They didn't want to rely on the German Jews, you know, innovations. Okay, so they asked the Gedolim Anshei Hashem Balei Tveisim B'Talmud the Poskim Lishmo Estatim B'Dovazeh Ulam. Okay, they got different answers. Eli Aminu be'Eli Yasmeilu. These say on the right. These say on the left. Rav Morer, Eli Rav Shmuel Mokluger from Brody, Tziva Tzavach Kechrukia. He was crying out like this bird that cries out. And then in his letter, and he said, "V'chachach Yitzias Atamra." And then he gave his reasons to say you can't. And then later on, you'll see Rav Shlomo, Rav Yosef Shlomo Nathanson is of Lemberg, is the one that's saying, "Nah, it's fine. Don't worry about it." And then you get later on. You can see it in big letters, about eight lines below the cross out, that Mordechai Zev Ettinger said that this stuff is chametz gomer. That if you eat matzah that's made by a machine, it's the same as eating chametz. You might as well put challah on your seder table. Okay. So that's the way the newspaper wrote about it. So they really got, you know, again, this is the second or third year that you have a Jewish weekly newspaper. So it's like, I want to read more about this. And you can. So the next week, somebody else, who's actually a lesser known person, his name is Rabbi Yosef Chaim Karo. He was a Rav in a place in Prussia. Again, everything is, you know, coming to Galicia from the closest part of German orbit to Galicia. It's a place called Bydgoszcz. I remember as an undergraduate at Yeshiva University, there was Poland was like falling apart, and there were all kinds of communism was getting, you know, their control over people was getting less and less, and there was a huge demonstration in Bydgoszcz, and they beat somebody, and this is before the days of the internet, but somebody was able to smuggle out a movie of the beating of this person in Bydgoszcz, and it really riled up Western opinion against the Jaruzelski regime, the one that was trying to keep Poland communist at the time. And I remember I was in the fifth floor of the library in NYU, and there was this old guy there who knew everything. His name was Rabbi Mandelbaum. And then the other guy said, There is big Gushin. This is part of Poland, you know, because when you talk about Polish Jews, almost all the Jews in Poland came from southeastern Poland, from this area of Galicia. Nobody knew where Bydgoszcz was. Rabbeinu goes, Bydgoszcz is going Deutscher. That was the German part. It wasn't really, before the war, it wasn't even German, it wasn't even Poland. It was really Germany. So there was this town called Bydgoszcz, which probably has a German name to it. And within Bydgoszcz today, there's another place called Pardan. And Pardan had a Jewish community, but Yosef Chaim Karo was the Rav of Pardan. Okay? He wrote a very nasty letter to the editor. I don't think I have the guts to read it all, but I did reproduce it for you here on the April 15th letter against the Shlomo Tugger and against the idea that there's a problem with machine matzahs. Okay? You can, as I said, go to the website of the Israel National Library and read the whole thing. Once that came out, that's, I think, what triggered when Chaim Nachum Demitzer to get Rav Shlomo Kluger to get people to write letters against the machine, and eventually also triggered him to publish the Bitul Modal. And in the, I'm sorry, the Modal of Eish Yisrael. In the Modal of Eish Yisrael, you'll actually find quotes from this letter to the editor, because they wanted to show how evil the opposition was and how disrespectful it was of Rav Shlomo Kluger. In a different letter, which is not in Hamagid, it was actually published by Art School. Art School has a book called Shnos Dor V'Dor. You can get it on HebrewBooks.org too, just in Hebrew, that has documents from different historical events that happened in the last couple of hundred years. And in that, they have a letter from Rabbi Yosef Chaim Karo to the Gerer Rebbe, in which the Rabbi Yosef Chaim Karo writes that he saw he wrote so viciously against Shlomo Kluger, he didn't know who he was. Which, it's hard to imagine that in 1858, somebody who was a Rav, even in the German part of Poland, never heard of Shlomo Kluger, didn't know who he was, didn't know his stature. But that's what he wrote. Maybe that was the only way he could defend himself. But the letter itself is very interesting. There's actually a photocopy of the handwritten letter in Shnos Dor V'Dor, and it's typed out in easy-to-read Hebrew. So I would refer you to that letter as well. And then, as I said, you look 2 weeks later on April 28th. It didn't come out on the same day of the week, maybe because of Yontif, maybe because it just didn't come out regularly, Bichlal. But you have a letter from Torn, which, as I said, was in Prussian, East Prussia, a Posen province of Germany, so to speak. And Reb Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, we always assumed was Polish or Lithuanian. He wasn't. He was really a Rav of a German-speaking community. And he was a well-known person in the history of Zionism. He got Rabbi Yosef Chaim Karo, the bad guy, to collaborate with him on some of his Zionist activities later. And in this letter, which I guess let's spend a little time looking at it. Let's look at it. Torin Yom Vav, okay. Lo echtol tachas vasai asher hei. How angry we are in our country, in Germany, about the Austrian, right, which is code for Galician, right? It's almost like something untrue came from their mouths. Right? That they should not rely on German rabbis. That it was a joke to them that the German rabbi said that you can use machine matzos. But Yachshavu, and these rabbis, the Galician rabbis, they think only they are the nation of the Torah world. The Torah Hashem defiem. And they are the ones who have the Torah in their mouths. The Hasidim Ashkenaz kolod nechshavu lamo. And the Hasidim of Ashkenaz, the Orthodox Jews of Germany, are disregarded by them. And they don't even think that saying that is an aveira. Okay? To think this kind of impure thought about Gedolim from Germany. It's true. There are a lot of problems in German Jewish communities. There's a lot of people who have left Orthodoxy. The Orthodox community is not, a joke. Right? Hema Eser Malos Yudalun Le'otem HaNisayam. And actually, the Jews who remain Orthodox in Germany are actually 10 times stronger, because they're actually ideologically Orthodox. Because they're not just Orthodox in the flow, because they come from communities where everybody's Orthodox, and that's just what you do. They actually have to think about and practice their Orthodoxy with their heads. Right? Eser Malos Yudalun Le'otem HaNisayam. Because the Nisayam is so great not to be Orthodox. Okay? So that is how he defended, you know, the attack. He wasn't even defending the machine matzah as much as he was defending the attack on the ability of German rabbis to be part of the conversation. Because what Rav Shlomo Kluge was saying was, they do mashalivam chavetz zed darkam, you know, just ignore them. You know, I mean, it's like, we don't want to have anything to do with that. That's not the way. That's not authentic. And what Rav Shlomo Kluge was saying is that's wrong. It's true that for whatever reason we have a large segment of our community which is not like that, but that doesn't taint the Orthodox communities that are in Germany. And later on, the irony of it, which we'll come to soon, is that it's actually more kosher. If you really cared about kashrus, you would say to yourself, what's better, you know, a process where the matzah takes 17 minutes out of the 18 to get into the oven, or a process that takes 4 minutes to get into the oven? Which one's going to be less likely to be chametz?
Many of the people in the Bitul Moda'a also express, and I'm using this in my Seder?
Yes, it's in the letter of the Tiferes Yisrael. It says, we only use machine matzahs in our town.
Yeah. They use it for shmur matzah also?
Yes. Yeah, that's a different issue, which we haven't focused as much on. You know, what about having it? So if you take away the issue of lishma, right? Yeah, because the matzah mitzvah is the issue of lishma. The issue of the corners is a problem, obviously, all Pesach, because it's a chametz problem. But yeah, in the Ksav Sofer also, the Ksav Sofer wrote, our problem is that, you know, they were in a more affluent community. They couldn't find those old ladies from, you know, these peripheral backgrounds to do the rolling. So there was nobody to do it, except non-Jews, which is definitely a problem. So they had to have the matzah made by machine. And so they had takanas about how to do it, but they only had takanas. They didn't have people. So, absolutely. In all these communities, what happened was that the hand matzah business stopped. It's kind of like, you know, buying a handmade car versus a machine-made car. And eventually, there's not going to be any handmade cars, because it's so much cheaper to have a machine-made car. So
people bake their own matzahs?
No.
Before Pesach?
No. I'm not sure why. And today they tell you that, you know, I always thought it would be a great way.
They used to go a few weeks before and they make...
In their own houses?
No, they would go to some bakery.
Right, the bakery
did. An 18 pit of matzah. Pit was some kind of...
Measurement. Right. Right. I know this. My father told me this also, that the way they kept their chont warm, nobody had a warm oven that stayed warm all Shabbos in their house. Mm-hmm. All the chonts were kept in the bakery. Right. And then on the way home from shul, you'd pick up your chont pot. I think that they didn't have the wealth to do it in their house. I'm not sure why we can't do it today. They say that, you know, the brick ovens are much stronger. We couldn't get our ovens to do matzahs. I'll try it once, but I don't know if you can get it to work. That's a real way to fight the $17 a pound hand matzah business. Just make them your own. Do it yourself.
Okay.
27, 37, 47. Okay. Now, I want to ask this question. Okay, so we're talking about the issue, and the historians who wrote about it have written that, you know, the hand matzah, the machine-made matzah was definitely an innovation, and we know exactly when it started. But at the same time, there were also mechanizations of other aspects of Jewish, you know, ritual material that didn't cause the same kind of a fight. This is a massive fight. But you didn't have the same kind of fight about machines that, for instance, grind the wheat into flour. Okay? Originally, before the Industrial Revolution, whenever grinding was done by hand or with an animal, right? They would take the hard kernels of the wheat and then put them in the millstone and have the animal walk around to separate the chaff and the flour and all that. And then somebody in the 1830s came up with the idea to have a steam-powered mill or a water-powered mill. And there were a couple of tshuvas here and there about that. There was also tshuvas about weaving machines to make talisim. There were two issues, making the talisim the body of the talis, and there were also machines that made the tzitzis. And was that, again, these are things which require lishma. Tzitzis, you know, and the fights that were out there were nothing compared to the fights with the matzah.
A few months ago, I was in Meir Sharon with the matzah factory. They have grinding the wheat. They have the kernels there. They have these yeshiva guys going around like this, you know, because it's all.
So that fight is still being fought about the grinding, right? But even those, there's even today those who are against using a machine to do the grinding, right? And they have the tshuvas. That's probably. What probably happened is they read those tshuvas and then they said, okay, this is really the way we're supposed to do it. It's not like they're coming. They're coming from it. Nobody was doing that. And that was discussed here too. By this point, nobody was doing the grinding by hand. Nobody saw a problem with using a machine to do the grinding, but they did see a problem with using the machine to do the after the kneading, setting up the matzahs themselves. And I believe that there's a simple answer. When you take a talis, right, or even take flour that you want to make matzah with, you have no way of telling. It doesn't. The optics are not there. And then there's the flour that's there looks the same whether it was done this way or that way. The talis looks the same whether it was woven or was done by hand. So it doesn't give you this affront that I'm not doing what my fathers did. But when you take a Manischewitz matzah box, you know, with a little square, and you say, "Wow, you know, I remember my Zadie had the, you know, the big round one with the burned bracket at the end." And you're going to say, "You know, I put on my blue satin yarmulke, and I sit down with my Maxwell House Haggadah, and I take my very crisp, clean-looking Manischewitz square matzahs." It just doesn't look traditional, right? So you're not going to be able to sell the innovation if the result, the end result, looks so different than what people are used to looking at. Whereas the talis looks the same.
It's all marketing.
It's all, in fact, I believe that's why the machine matzah that they sell today looks different. There's no reason why it has to look different than the Horowitz Margaret and Manischewitz matzah. It's flour. Why does it look different? If you look at any box of machine matzah, you look at it and just take, you can take it and you can look at it. You see, it looks more coarse, it looks less refined. It's because that has anything to do with lishma. We're talking about shmur matzah, right? So the whole shmur matzah is a mental process that you're making it lishma. So why does the when you do lishma, does it change the way the flour looks? No. But the people that you're trying to sell the machine shmur matzah to expect that it look, you know, different than the regular matzah, and that's part of the marketing. Yeah.
That speaks to today, not to them.
Yes, that's correct. Then they probably all look the same. There's one with small square, one was, and actually that's what they ended up doing. So originally they did the round one, then they got into trouble with the corners, and then they started saying, okay. So then there became a whole fight about whether square matzahs were against the Masorah. And that was also in the literature. And then there were those who said, but, you know, in Izmir, somebody had to go there to find out, but in Izmir, in Turkey, which had a large Jewish community, all the bread and all the challah is rectangular. So, you know, you can't say it's against the Masorah. And then somebody said, well, the lechem apanim, the Gemara talks about it as being rectangular, so how can you say that, you know, that the bread has to be round to be part of the Masorah? So, you know, this all became, what you expect became part of the conversation, so to speak.
That's how long you won't, how far back you won't give a sower to go.
That's also true. Okay. Okay, now it's interesting that, you know, as I said, in the beginning, the Hasidim have taken this on. It's made it almost like a marker. Like, the Chabad people are out there before Pesach with these little boxes of hand shmur matzah. Now, if you were to take out a little box of machine shmur matzah and say, here, have this at your seder, they would be very, you know, they wouldn't know what to answer, because what they want to do, I think, is that they want you to be able to have your traditional seder. And traditional seder to them means doing, you know, and it always made an article of faith that you have to use your hand shmur matzah, at least at the seder. So they don't want this, you know, Maxwell House Haggadah kind of seder with those neat little machine matzahs. It's important that you use the hand, you know, that's the way of defining who you are in terms of, you know, what hotel you go to and what kind of a matzah you're going to eat for Pesach. And the issue actually never died out. Ironically, it got a second wind and a third wind and a fourth wind, but not because people were out to defend German Orthodoxy. The second and the third wind were coming from the Lithuanian Jews, the Briskers and the Chazon Ish types, who wanted to be more punctilious in their observance. And they know, everybody knows deep down, that the matzah that's made in 4 minutes is going to be less likely to be chametz than the matzah that's made in 16 minutes. And so there, you had in the first decade of the 20th century a fight in Yerushalayim with Shi Pesach Frank. A lot of the Prussian, the Yerushalmi, you know, Talmidei HaGra type, you know, Misnagdim, who were very firm, said the only matzah you can eat is machine matzah. And the Hasidim in Israel were saying, no, the sons of Rebbe said, the Ger Rebbe said, if you're not doing this, and we'll see what they said in a minute, you know, you're going against the Mitzvah. Let's take a look at it, you know. So this became a fight not just from the 1850s, it was revived in the first decade of this century, and it's even around after World War II. Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach only ate machine matzahs. He came from a Yerushalmi background. Let's look, if we can, at the... Okay, so it's the reverse of the page with the cross out. So the reverse of the sensory page. Okay, larger print. Okay. On the left side, you have the two letters that are from Odol Beis Yisrael, parts of the two letters. One from the sons of Rav, Reb Chaim Halberstam, and the bottom left from the Ger Rebbe. Okay, so let's just look at the sons of first. The Dvar She'elasam Mutal Asos Hamatzas Chag HaPetzach Be'emtzos HaMashin. Okay, you're asking me, Reb Chaim Nosson Demetzer, you're asking me whether you can use machine matzahs in Krakow. Okay, I saw the tshuva of Reb Shlomo Kluger and of Reb Mordechai Zev Ettinger, the brother-in-law of Reb Shlomo Yosef Shlomo Nosson, she'eskimu shneim le'esor v'tzotku ma'od b'divreihem. Okay, even though on some of it I can answer that the Lashma is a weak argument, but whatever, I agree with them in principle. Okay, but there's enough of a reason to answer because of what Reb Mordechai Zev said, Shirov Einav Es HaMashin, which Rav Yosef Shalom Natanson disagreed with, that he actually saw it, but he says he saw it, and you can't stick away, you can't scrape away the little pieces of dough. Iyav Shaligur HaHetev HaNidbakbo B'kama M'sholom Yochel Nitzmah Hazeh. Okay, now he says, "Ulam gam ledati habei ta'amim api din le'asor achen kmusim iti." This is a way to fight innovation that isn't necessarily against halacha. He said, "I have a lot of other reasons, but we're not going to talk about them. We're not going to get into a conversation with you about the halachic aspects." Okay, there are many reasons. Achen kmusim imyadi. They're hidden with me. Kasha kiken kibalt epi mimori v'chami. Ragami Leichnik, that was his father-in-law, wrote a sefer called Baruch Tam. He wasn't a chassid. He said, "V'shebekamos elu advarim ein legalas atam." And when it comes to these kind of ideological fights with the non, you know, with the people who are orthodox, you know, but not our kind of orthodox, the best thing is don't reveal the reason. Rak lifsoch adin behechleit. Just tell them what the din is. V'hashemeh yishma. The rest of it. V'achadol yachdol. Don't get into the halachic aspects of it, which is often what happens in these kinds of issues even today. That it becomes a fight of, you know, accept Das Torah, and that's the end of it. And look at the next one, similar thing. Adash, the Chidushe Harim, Rabbi Yitzchak Meir, Adash, Elosam, Odas, Asiyas, Hamatzas, Lachad, HaPesach, Haidem, Bashin. Again, Hagam, Kilo, Yisiyam, Olam. This is the, you know, I never saw it, but I can tell you, Olam, according to what Mordechai Zev Ettinger writes, in the Nimaskim Lassor, Kidvar of Nemar, and Bitzedek, and this is the important part. Hashem, Yatzilas, Amo, Me'osan, Anoshim. Hashem should save his people from these people, Shluchai, Yitzhahara. They're the messengers of the Yitzhahara. Talmidei Yeravam ben Nevat. Right? This is the way Yeravam ben Nevat, who separated, you know, Jews into two nations. You have the nation of Ashkenaz and the nation of Poland, right? And you have Yeravam ben Nevat, Talmidim of Yeravam ben Nevat, Hamischaknim, Nenashel Mikom Mitzvah Ma'at Ma'at. They are, they're Ivachacham, they're smart to chip away at every mitzvah a little bit. V'chavanosam, but what's their real goal? V'chavanosam la'akor sakol. Their real goal is to uproot all of Yiddishkeit, as you can see from their deeds. I mean, this is coming at the time when Reform Judaism was actually being fought. But this was the first fight where it wasn't Orthodox against Reform, it was Orthodox against Orthodox. Right? Hashem should destroy their intent. That's how Hashem Hisakun. That's how Tfisu has one last, and should publish this. Yes.
Was the Shi'i Masa adopted by Reform Jews as well?
I'm sure. I mean, they came from communities that didn't even have hand matzah. I mean, the Reform was strongest in Germany. As I said, a lot of these communities didn't even have the option of having hand matzah. I think it's a good paradigm for how a fight between a modern Orthodox, that's why I entitled it. Is there a way to have a conversation where you just say, you know, and these kinds of things, don't even talk about it with them. Just say it's usher. Okay. I want to say one more thing, and this, you know, on the same page as the lineup, okay, this is again from the Bitul Mo'adah. This is one of the surrogates of Reb Shlomo Kluger, and he writing against, he was very, very upset about that vicious letter to the editor in Hamagid. And so he, this is what you have today also, you have ad hominem attacks against the proponent, not because of the halachic argument that he's making, but because of the person that he is. Okay, so it's worth looking about. Let's go about three lines down. Ra'isi Shu'al Katan, right? These are all, you know, hypertext. You have to know, if you know Chazal, you know, Shu'alim Katanim Mechavlim Kramim from Shir Hashim, right? I saw this small fox, not a very, you know, a little mosquito. Merake Ben HaKramim. He's dancing among the vineyards. Harei Yisrael Magini Oretz. Who are the vineyards? The great poskim. The Gdolei Ador, the Gdolim. Who Bekal Kadosh of Pardan Berpreisen, right? He's in Bidgosh, right, which is now includes Pardan in Prussia. Uchsil Chovek Yadav, right? So again, Psukim from I believe Mishle. Uchsil Chovek Daber Mashalos, to talk nonsense, Vahatir Hamashim. To be mad at the machine, say Adonin, Marini, Rav Agon, Rosh Verishon, the Gedolin, right? The Rosh Verishon, Lesser, right? That's Rav Shlomo Kluger, Mishneyu, Yedidenu, Rav Agon, Marini, Rav Chazev Ettinger. So he, this guy, Rav Yosef Chaim Karo, is coming to be mad with these two Gedolin Aser. Vezei Yachbog Oz Kanomer, Ludabe Ba'azus. He speaks with Chutzpah, Vene'atzos Rabos, and great. In fact, he himself is not able to distinguish between what's mutter and what's usser. So I have this joke about him. Today he's a German. How does Rav Yosef Chaim Karo published a pirush on Pirkei Avos that was bilingual? They had the same text, the same substance in Hebrew on one side and in German on the other side. It was already published in 1858. He wrote other svarim that were totally rabbinic svarim, but he wrote many other svarim, and one of these svarim that he had already published was this sefer that was bilingual with a parish on Pirkei Avos, and he wrote it for the assimilated Jews in his area who didn't even know how to read Hebrew, and he figured they can benefit from Pirkei Avos in the vernacular. So, Lama Lushano Ladaber Fater Mutter. So he doesn't say, you know, Tati Mami, he says Fater Mutter. He speaks German. Lachain, Hakoba Inovi Mutter. So he started to say Fater Mutter, Mutter. Everything became Mutter, even the machine, which should definitely be Usser. So this is a cultural critique of him. It's not just that he says everything's Mutter, it's that he became a German. He taught himself how to be a German rabbi, and he kept saying Mutter, and that's what German rabbis do. So that is the a current, I think, that underruns the halachic discussion here, that we're dealing with a slippery kind of Orthodox Judaism that is able to say Mutter to a lot of things that they really shouldn't be saying Mutter to. Okay, so as I said, the issue is still with us. I mean, you know, if you Google it, just Google machine matzahs, you'll see that there have been articles in at the very end of the Jewish Observer, when they stopped, I think, in the mid-2000s, but in 2004, there's an article about Mishim Matzis, about the controversy between Rav Shlomo Kluger and Yosef Shalnathanson. It's actually quite open in that it quotes even the Hamagid. So there's an article in the Jewish Observer. You can find articles in the Jewish Action, in Ami magazine, in Mishpacha. And as I said, the reason why it's still an issue, what's revived it, isn't because people are out there to support German-style, practical, you know, analysis, and with not wedded to the shape of the matzah. What's really keeping Mishim Matzis alive is actually the frumkeit of people who are still saying, until today, that Mishim Matzis are actually more kosher. Now, what I can see in the future is it's quite conceivable, the way technology keeps developing, it's quite conceivable that somebody will invent a machine matzah, a machine that has sensors every square inch, so that if there's any piece of dough, the whole factory will shut down. The electricity will get cut off. Right? They don't have an email, but you can have the Eidach HaRedes telephone ring, and you show Yerushalayim as soon as the sensor detects that there's a piece of dough on the machine. And the technology already exists today to do that. And we can create a machine that is totally, totally pure and of the critique that little pieces of matzah get stuck. And we can create a totally pure person, you know, who's accepted, get Rav Shlomo Kluger himself to push the button, and then there's no lishma issue. Right? So it's conceivable that somebody is going to be able to create this is much better than the machine. It used to be they weren't so sure, but this machine really is kosher. And then the fight will come back again, and there will have to be more arguments to make about why hand matzah is really what the Ger Rebbe said we have to do. So it's not over yet, I think, and it's early enough in the year that we should be discussing it.
So to what do you attribute that even in today's modern Orthodox community a handmade matzah at the Seder?
Right, it's a good question. I don't know. I think it's part of it is the optics. You know, you just don't want to, you want to have a traditional Seder. You know?
I don't think it has to do with that at all. I think the difference in taste between the machine-baked shmur matzah and the hand-baked is a world apart. Because I grew up from the German side,
right.
we used only machine matzahs.
Right.
The first time I was introduced to hand-baked matzahs, I said, how could I have eaten this all these years? To make a mitzvah out of eating cardboard?
I can agree with you. I would agree with you, but I don't taste. I want to use hand matzahs. I don't know.
Outside of the halachic issue, Pesach from Hashkafa issue, Pesach more than any other holiday has to do with father to son and his father and his father. So is it possible that if you take all the halachic things and push them aside, Pesach as opposed to every other holiday in the book is something that you would more. That you tend to be more interested in what your ancestors did than you would on Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur.
100%. Let's say you were stuck in Nome, Alaska, in an Air Force base, and there was only one Seder there, and it was entirely done in English. Okay, you'd sit through it. This is what I would do. You'd sit through it and you'd say, you know 100% you're Yotze. In fact, the Shulchan Aruch itself says that you're supposed to do the Seder in the vernacular. And what would you do when it's done? You'd pick up the Haggadah and say the whole thing to yourself. Because that's the way you expect the Seder to do. But you have to realize that that's not, you know, to make to do it is one thing. To say that that's the only way to do it.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying Pesach is different. Let's say in Rosh Hashanah you were in Nome, Alaska, and they said everything in English. You might want to say it in Hebrew too, but not for the same reason. Rosh Hashanah doesn't have the same thing with your ancestors as Pesach.
And that may be why, like in the Soviet Union, you know, they didn't necessarily keep all the holidays, but they were very big about having matzah for Pesach. Because there's something about, maybe because it's a family holiday, it's celebrated at home. 100% possible.
Most widely observed.
Except maybe, that of Hanukkah.
As we heard, you Ashkenazi, you're probably what matzahs were. You're probably more like you.
Right, but that's already a more nuanced, that even the ham matzahs are not really matzahs. But, yeah. Okay. Enjoy your matzah.